spaces before you get back. Sarah's going to continue and get back to the real work of doing inflationary cosmological perturbation theory and so on. But so to end with, we'll do the case of most relevance to inflation, which is De Sitter spacetime. And inflation, the period of inflation is always De Sitter plus some small corrections. And so at zeroth order, you want to understand what happens to quantum fields in De Sitter spacetime. And De Sitter spacetime, of course, is a maximally symmetric spacetime like Minkowski space. If you like this kind of thing, it's actually a coset space of SO14 over SO13. And if you're not familiar with that, what that notation means, it doesn't matter. But basically, it's telling you that the isometry group of De Sitter, that is the group of the killing vectors on the space-time, the actual symmetry of the space-time, is SO14, and the isotropy group, which is the symmetry you have left when you fix a point in space and then you look around you and what are the remaining symmetries of the space after you've fixed a point. So that's why it's isotropy is the symmetries once you've fixed a point is SO13. And you can represent it in a way that manifests these symmetries as a hyperboloid. So four-dimensional De Sitter space you can represent as a hyperboloid in 1 plus 4 dimensions. So that means 1 time and 4 space dimensions. And so the equation, so we take a metric which looks like minus dx0 squared plus dx123 squared plus dx4 squared. And the equation, and De Sitter space can be defined as the surface embedded in this 5-dimensional space which satisfies the equation x naught squared plus the sum of the 3 spatials squared plus x4 squared is h minus 2, where h is the Hubble constant. And this makes the symmetry manifest that if I do, on these coordinates, xA, I do a Lorentz transformation, lambda AB, XB, where lambda belongs to SO, the group SO14, then by definition, the very definition of this group is that it leaves this quantity invariant. And so that's really, and so that you see that equation manifests the symmetries of De Sitter space. And if you draw, physically, if you draw that as a picture, so a nice way to look at this is to say, rewrite it as x squared plus x4 squared is h to the minus 2 plus x0 squared. And if this side was a constant, this would exactly be the equation defining the embedding of a sphere in Euclidean space. Except now the radius is actually a function of x naught, and it's minimized at h to the minus 2, but then it gets bigger as x naught gets bigger. And bigger also as x naught gets bigger in the negative direction. So it looks like this. Hyperboloid, in which the sections going this way are 3 spheres, and that's the best I can do to draw a 3 sphere is really a circle. So that 3 sphere has the equation x squared plus x4 squared is radius squared, where the radius is the square root of h to the minus 2 plus x0 squared, and the minimum size is here. The minimum sphere is here and has radius. The radius there is exactly the Hubble radius. And these embedding coordinates... Yep. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Should the next line down be xA prime?
xA prime. Yeah, sure. And the advantage of this, these embedding coordinates is that you can naturally define the generators of the Lorentz of the SO, the generators of SO14, the isometry group, of a natural expression in terms of these embedding coordinates. And here I'm raising and lowering with respect to the five-dimensional metric, eta b, which is minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. So that's an explicit representation, the scalar representation of the generators of the isometry group, SO14. And the De Sitter space has the same symmetries as the Poincaré group. It's got 10 generators. It's because there are 10 of these things, because this is antisymmetric. And there's actually a limit, basically, in which H minus 1 goes to infinity. So where the Hubble size goes to infinity, the curvature goes to 0. There's a limit in which De Sitter space looks like the Poincaré space, looks like flat space. Therefore, there's a limit at which the De Sitter group, the limit in which the De Sitter group, SO14, must approach the Poincaré group. And this limiting process is called a Wigner-Inonu, there's some umlaut somewhere there, I think it's there, contraction. And the way that basically plays out is that you can split the generators MAB, where remember that A is running from 0 to 4, so there's five dimensions in the embedding space, but you split it up into the four dimensions, mu nu, where mu runs from 0 to 3, and then you have an extra one, which is mu 4. 4 mu is obviously the antisymmetric combination, and 4 4 is itself 0. So from a four-dimensional point of view, what you have is something that has exactly the form. These are just the SO13 generators of the Lorentz group. And these things are vectors, which in the limit give you precisely the momenta of the Poincaré group. Yeah?
So you said that when h goes to infinity, then this becomes flat space?
H minus 1 goes to infinity. Yeah.
How is that flat space? We would have x0 squared plus x squared plus
x. Yeah, you can't. So you take you have to take the limit in a subtle way. So it's not a simple, you can set this side to 0. You have to take some things to infinity at the same time as other things goes to 0. That's why it's not completely a straightforward limit to do. But it does work out. Yeah, it's a kind of, yeah. I forget how it works, actually. It's a little bit subtle. But anyway, I mean, common sense tells you it's got to work, because there must be a limit in which De Sitter looks like Poincaré. Yeah?
If I just think of this as that quotient of groups, is there a way I can take the limit? Like, I can add some parameter in the groups to...
Yeah, you're doing a scaling. So, okay. So if I wrote out the Lie algebra for these things, then the mu nus would just satisfy the Lorentz group, because that really is a true subgroup. Mu fours would satisfy the correct commutations with these that they should do for these to be vectors. This is a vector, so, and this is a generator of a rotation, so that'll transform. So the only non-trivial one that differs between the two is that in the De Sitter case, P mu and P nu don't commute, but they give you something proportional to mu nu, whereas in the Poincaré case, P mu is 0. And so that you can achieve that limit by just saying, let's rescale the generators P mu as 1 over lambda P mu here, so that this equation then becomes like that, and then you set lambda to 0. And that's how you achieve the contraction. So always these Wigner and Onu contractions correspond to, you do some trick where you rescale the generators, and then you send some parameter to infinity. So you're guaranteed a consistent truncation of the Lie algebra because it was consistent before, and it's consistent at every value of lambda, and then you take lambda to infinity, and it's still consistent. Anyway. So physically, this picture represents de Sitter space in what's called the closed slicing, where spatial sections are spheres, as is obvious. Every section this way is a sphere, and time's running that way. And to write that in more familiar system of coordinates that we'd actually use in cosmology, we take this space, which is a five-dimensional space, and then we look at the induced metric on the surface, xa, xa is h minus 2. And remember that because I'm raising and lowering with respect to the Minkowski metric, there's a minus in there in the first sign. The simplest way to see that is to do some change of coordinates where I write x0, x1, x2, x3, x4 as h minus 1. So just do some redefinitions. These things are all going to be h minus 1 times cosh h tau multiplied by, so this factor for every one of those, I'm just not going to rewrite it each time. This one a cos chi, this one sine chi cos theta, this one sine chi sine theta, and this one sine chi sine theta, sorry, cos phi, sine theta, sine phi. And this is a standard trick of way of rewriting the coordinates to guarantee that this subspace essentially is a three-sphere, which is what we know it had to be. And so when you plug this change of coordinates, so the first thing you should note is that this change of coordinates naturally satisfies this condition. So if I sum up these squares and then difference this one squared, it's going to work because what's going to happen is when I sum up these squares, you can do it, let's do it in pairs. So when I square this and square this, these are the same except there's a sine and a cosine, but when you sum the sine squared and cosine squared, that gives you a 1, so that goes away. Then you add that combination to this one. This is the same with that, except that's a sine, that's a cosine, and you do the same again, so that gives you a 1. And then the sum of the three gives you a sine squared. You add it to that one, gives you a cos squared. That gives you a 1. So the sum of all these squares just gives you a cos squared. And then you minus, because of the minus in the metric, the sinh squared, and cos squared minus sinh squared is 1. And you get precisely that. So that's a standard trick to do that embedding. And so when you plug all those formula into this five-dimensional metric and look at the induced metric on the four-dimensional surface, you get something that looks like this. You get a closed k equals plus 1 FRW universe as where this is the metric on a three sphere, which in these coordinates is I guess it's d chi squared plus sine squared chi times the metric on the two-sphere. And the metric on the two-sphere is d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared, which is the metric on a one-sphere. So what we're doing is we're making up an n-sphere by embedding lower-dimensional spheres inside it, and then you always take with the sine. So de Sitter space in one representation is a closed Friedman-Roberts-Walker universe with k equals plus 1. And it has the feature that it's actually it's expanding in the future, but in the past it was contracting. Because a cosh grows like an exponential. Cosh h tau goes like e to the h tau as tau goes to plus infinity. Actually a half, if we're being pedantic. As tau goes to plus infinity. And as tau goes to minus infinity, it goes as 1/2 e to the minus h tau, and therefore also blows up. So the full De Sitter space is a contracting and expanding universe. It contracts, and then it bounces, and then it starts to expand again. Physically, the reason it bounces is although normally your intuition is when things collapse, everything's going to go wrong, you're going to hit a singularity. Here, it's the curvature of the space, the fact that this is a free sphere, which compensates in the Friedman equation. If you think you've got h squared, if you look at the way curvature comes in, h squared is 1 over 3m Planck squared rho minus k over a squared. So in De Sitter, this particular combination is a constant, and then you've got this minus k over a squared piece. And k is positive. So what happens as the scale factor gets, if you come in the contracting phase, as the scale factor gets smaller and smaller, this thing gets bigger and bigger. But this can never get bigger than that because the combination has to be positive. So when this hits the value of the energy density, which is constant, what happens is that then the universe has to bounce and switch around and start expanding. And that's precisely what happens at this minimum radius here.
How do we see that k
equals
plus 1?
Because it's a three. The definition of k is plus 1 was that the spatial sections were a three sphere.
Oh, okay.
That was what it means. So that's just the full De Sitter space in all its glory. And from that, in this form, it's very easy to work out its Penrose diagram, which is going to be useful for thinking about the causal structure. So the Penrose diagram, what we do is we take a conformal mapping of the space. We take our infinite space, and we conformally map it to some, I'm going to call it conformally mapped space, which is effectively compact. And if you're lucky, you can make it so that it has, so the full De Sitter space has topology R cross S3, because you've got spheres going this way, evolving in time. And you want to make this thing look like an Einstein static universe. Which is exactly which is actually where the metric is literally R cross S3 with no time dependence. And this you can do very easily here, because if you just take out the h to the minus 2 cosh squared h tau out of the metric, then you've got your tau squared h squared of the cosh squared h tau plus a free sphere. And then you just change coordinates to some variable u, let's say, which is integral h d tau of a cosh h tau, so that this conformally related metric is exactly an Einstein static universe, which means that it's literally R cross S3. And the key feature is that although tau runs from minus infinity to plus infinity, this coordinate is actually finite because you can see that simply because the cosh always goes to infinity as tau goes to infinity exponentially, and so this integral is always convergent as tau goes to plus infinity, and similarly it's convergent as tau goes to minus infinity. So the coordinate u runs over only a finite distance. And this three sphere here, of course, is actually, let me write the three sphere now as d chi squared plus sine squared chi times a 2-sphere. And remember that chi has to run from 0, but only to pi over 2, because essentially, sorry, it runs to pi. Does it run to pi? Runs to pi, right? So it's, so what we're doing is we're taking a 3-sphere and we're slicing it in 2 spheres, and 0 is at the bottom, it's the south pole, and pi is at the top, is the north pole. So the chi coordinate runs over a finite distance. So in the Penrose diagram, what we do, just to make our life easy, is we suppress the 2-sphere direction, and we just plot out essentially the u direction going this way, that's time, which is now compact, and the chi direction going this way, which is also compact. So the Penrose diagram for De Sitter is just a box, and the closed slicing covers this box as follows. These directions are 3 spheres, so each one of these is a surface of constant tau. Which is a surface of constant u. So remember that the diagram, the picture represents an Einstein static universe. We've suppressed the 2-sphere direction. So this is the best, this, but each one of these is a 3-sphere, although it doesn't look like it. So there's the south pole here and the north pole there. So each one of those is a 3-sphere, and so your surfaces of constant proper time are 3 spheres. Now, we almost never use this metric in cosmology. Even though we're always interested in De Sitter space, we almost never use that. And it's precisely because of this rather artificial thing that the full De Sitter space goes from a collapsing universe to an expanding universe. But whenever you put matter in it, just a little bit, what will happen is that collapsing phase will always collapse and form a singularity, or so something could go wrong. So what we are, in practice, what we're only going to do is use the half of De Sitter space, which corresponds to an expanding universe. That's the only bit we're interested in. And the coordinates that cover that half are precisely the k equals 0 representation of De Sitter space, the one that we're more familiar with, which is where we have flat slices like this, and h is now exactly a constant, because in the Friedmann equation we've taken k equals 0. So in both cases, rho is a constant. Now we're also going to take k equals 0. So this is the so-called flat slicing of De Sitter. It's just related to that coordinate system by some complicated coordinate transformation that I'm not going to write down because it's not very illuminating. But really, this is just a coordinate transformation away from that representation. But it differs in the following sense. It only covers, in the Penrose diagram, it only covers exactly half the space. And so these surfaces, in here, the surfaces of constant t look like this. And what, by covering only half, what we've done is we've thrown away, this is the part of the De Sitter space that's collapsing, and this is the part that's expanding. And so we're precisely able to throw away the collapsing region at the price of having some initial null surface, on which we're going to have to put initial data. So we'll almost always basically just throw away this region. And then in these coordinates, this line here, this null line, is actually the point t is minus infinity, where the scale factor a of t goes to 0. Yeah. So, because we're taking the same space, but we're slicing it up in different ways. So the if we calculate the full space-time curvature, then so if we calculate r in both cases, then you're going to get the same answer, that it's 12 h squared, exactly a constant. But there are many different ways to slice a space up. You know, even Minkowski space, you can slice it with open slices or closed slices and so on. And so these are just different coordinate representations of the same space. So if we sliced it this way, it looks like closed slices. We slice it that way, it looks like flat slices. If we slice it this way, these look like open slices with k equals minus 1. So there's a way to do that as well. So De Sitter space can do everything you want it to. It could be an open universe, a closed universe, or a flat universe.
So it doesn't really make sense to say De Sitter space has positive curvature.
No. It does if you really talk about global De Sitter space, because this coordinate, the open coordinate system, just covers this quarter here. The flat coordinate system just covers this region here. Only the closed coordinate system covers the whole space. But as I say, in practice, we're never interested in the whole of De Sitter space. We're only ever interested in this half, or even sometimes this quarter. Yeah?
Is it possible to draw the flat slices in this diagram?
It is, and it's absolutely horrendous. This line here is something like a line that goes right down the middle there. If you want to throw away the collapsing region, just keep the expanding part. And then these surfaces here coming up are something like surfaces that go like that as we come up. No, it's kind of a horrendous mess. So, but roughly speaking, you split the hyperboloid into two, and then you're looking at slices going up like that. But of course, there's an odd thing that, you know, all of these are time-like surfaces in the sense that they are. Is that the right way around? It's time-like if it's just a spatial metric. But this guy is a null surface. No, is that the right? Anyway. You know what I mean. So this is space directions. But this guy is a null surface. That's the guy at minus infinity. T is minus infinity. That's where the scale factor goes to 0. In a general spacetime, you would say when the scale factor goes to 0, you've hit a singularity. But De Sitter space is a maximally symmetric space. It has finite curvature. There are no singularities in that space. And so it escapes death at the singularity by making it actually a horizon. A null surface here. And there's yet another coordinate system that's useful in De Sitter space, and is going to be relevant to its thermal nature. And that's the so-called static slicing. So all of the previous metrics I've given you, this guy, this one I haven't given you, but it has the same property as the others in that the metric is explicitly time dependent. So there's a scale factor there, which is a function of time. But there's another coordinate system that I derived for you in a few lectures ago, which is the so-called flat slicing. No, sorry, static slicing. Which was where the metric looked like dt squared 1 minus h squared r squared plus dr squared over 1 minus h squared plus r squared times a 2-sphere. Does anybody remember me doing that? So I don't have to do it again. So the trick was you start with the flat coordinates. Where you write now the R3 as dr squared plus r squared times the 2-sphere. And you define capital R was e to the ht times little r, so that this e to the ht is absorbed inside, so it looks like something like that. And here you have an off-diagonal term, and then you do a shift in t to make it diagonal. So this capital T and this T are related just by a shift. Okay, let me do it again. T squared, 1 minus h squared r squared, just the r squared minus 2 hr dr dt plus r squared t2 times the 3-sphere. And so the transformation is t. Is t plus integral hr over 1 minus h squared r squared dr. So that's how you get to that coordinate system. And on the Penrose diagram, that coordinate system, so we started with the flat coordinate system. So whatever this region describes, it must be embeddable just on this part of the space which the flat coordinate system covers. And in fact, it covers precisely this causal diamond region. So this thing is, so let's suppose you've got an observer who's sat here on the Penrose diagram, who's sat at the North Pole. One of the things we know about De Sitter space is that it has a future event horizon. And that's precisely this line here. Because essentially, any observer who's sat over here and sends a signal can't send a signal faster than light, and so he can never send a signal which will get to this observer. So this is a future event horizon, just as we had for an accelerated observer in Minkowski space. For the Unruh radiation, we precisely had the same diagram where we had a future event horizon and a past event horizon. Here, in this case, it's not a past event horizon because we're throwing away the rest of the space. It's actually the Big Bang, in some sense, because it's where the scale factor goes to zero. Yeah.
So which way is time?
Time is always going this way in these diagrams. Yeah. So these coordinates, if we drew them out, would look like they cover the space like this. And then with lines emanating that way. So these are slices of constant time, and those are slices of constant space. The original slices were the ones for the flat coordinate system here, these ones here.
And the slices of constant
time? These are slices of constant time. And then the other ones go sort of like that. That's how that one's covered. So the crucial thing is that this coordinate system, the static slicing, is the coordinate system that just covers the region that an observer here who's sat at the North Pole can see. Because he has a future event horizon, so he doesn't care about what's going on over here. It's never going to affect him. And again, that's going to be the key to the fact that De Sitter has a finite temperature, just like the Unruh effect. And another way to see that is to also see, so actually in these coordinates, the horizon, this surface here, is precisely the surface R is H minus 1. It's the physical size of the horizon, the event horizon now. It's a real honest horizon in De Sitter space. And you can also see, so let's look at this, the form of the metric near the surface R equals H minus 1. To do that, let's do another coordinate transformation. Let's write R is H minus 1, 1 plus rho squared over H squared. I just choose to change my coordinates like that. And we're going to work in the regime where rho is much less than h minus 1, so that r is approximately h, which is near the horizon. So let's look at the metric in the vicinity of the horizon. If we do that, 1 minus h squared r, oh, sorry, I'll put a minus there, because we have to work in the region r is less than h minus 1. If we do that, 1 minus h squared r squared is approximately 1 minus 1 minus rho squared over h squared squared. And now I'm going to put a 2 in there to make my life easy, so that this thing is approximately rho squared over h squared near the horizon. Any questions about that?
Rho
measures the distance from the horizon. So when rho is 0, r is h minus 1, and then it's just a way, it's just a, it doesn't matter, it's a coordinate, it's just a way to parameterize that difference. And under this transformation, dr is minus, sorry, I beg your pardon, I made a mess there. The h was supposed to be on top. Under that transformation, dr goes to minus h minus 1 rho d rho, just differentiating this expression. You've got a rho squared, you differentiate, the 2 goes away. So you plug that into the metric and just look at the metric in the vicinity of rho is 0, and you get ds squared is minus h squared rho squared dt squared plus this thing squared, h to the minus 2, rho squared, d rho squared, over, sorry, that was h to the plus 1, thanks. H to the plus 2, rho squared, d rho squared, over this combination, which is roughly h squared, rho squared. Plus, and then this thing we can just take to be h to the minus 2, d2 omega s2. So in other words, this thing cancels. This is d rho squared minus h squared rho squared dt squared plus h to the minus 2 d2 omega s2. Hopefully you'll immediately recognize this is what we were doing yesterday. This is precisely Rindler space. Now with some extra sphere direction running along just for the hell of it. And so this is a generic property that the near horizon geometry the near event horizon geometry of most spaces looks exactly like Rindler space. And then you can go through the same argument. If I Wick rotate that space to the Euclidean, then regularity in the Euclidean space tells me that it has to be periodic in Euclidean space. And we know if things are periodic in Euclidean space, that corresponds to a temperature, and so on and so on and so on. Yeah?
So the thing that we get from this is
someone being on one of these continents coordinates. But which one?
Say that again. So the fact.
Who's observing exactly? So
just any of just one observer who we here we have chosen to be at R is zero.
All these different constant
coordinates. Yeah.
All get the same temperature.
Yes. That's right. So this is a property that is not manifest in this picture, but because de Sitter space had this symmetry, every inertial observer, just in Minkowski space, all observers who are moving at constant velocity are related to each other by a Lorentz transformation. So they're the class of inertial observers. De Sitter space is exactly the same same as true. So this guy is sat here at R equals zero, but some guy who's moving away from him who's boosted relative to him by a de Sitter transformation, in this case, will also see exactly the same thing because the space itself is de Sitter invariant. And so all observers have to agree, all inertial observers, where inertial is defined as the observers which are related by a de Sitter transformation, have to agree.
Because if you read this diagram as a regular Wendler diagram in Minkowski,
yeah,
your boost would move you along one of these coordinates, and to move from one parabola or another, you actually need to assert your frame, whereas in this case, we can actually just boost from one hyperbola to the next, and so they all get the same temperature, or?
Yes, pretty much, yeah. So, yeah, another way of saying it.
Do you have the boosts on this, on the Penrose diagram?
Can I do that? I'm not sure I can, actually. It might be a little bit difficult.
But it wouldn't be as simple as just Minkowski.
So, I mean, one thing I can say, so the full space of de Sitter I can't do for you, but the one I can is that we chose this guy to be sat at the North Pole, but I could have just sat him here, right? And then the diagram would have looked slightly different like this. His causal region would look like that. But the same argument would go through, essentially. So for the general boost, I'm not even sure how to do it, to be honest. But let me move on because I know I'm running out of time, so I want to get to the crux of the matter. The bottom line is that because of the de Sitter invariance, all inertial observers agree on the same temperature, and that's the difference with the Unruh effect. Because now we're talking about observers who are just sitting at rest, but they see a temperature. Whereas in Minkowski space, the observer had to be accelerated to see a temperature. Here, nobody sees no temperature. Everybody sees a temperature, at least, if not more. Okay, so let's go back to the flat slicing to quantize the field. So I'll do this quickly because I know you should have done in the homework problems, and by now we've done several problems like this. So the metric in the flat slicing, I'm going to switch to conformal time because life becomes easy in conformal time. So this is the same as this, provided I define A of eta is 1 over minus H eta and minus h eta is then e to the minus ht. So that's just doing the conformal transformation to de Sitter. And we now know the general rule is if you have a field, if I rescale it by 1 over a, then the equation of motion for the field in conformal time is phi double prime is minus k squared phi plus A double prime over A for a massless scalar field. I'm just going to work with a massless case. Again, just to make my life simple. Although in this case, you can do it in the massive case relatively straightforwardly. That's the equation that the fields have to satisfy. We're going to decompose the field into creation annihilation operators, where these are some positive frequency modes, UK. E to the I k dot x ak plus uk negative frequency, which is the complex conjugate, ak dagger e to the minus I k dot x all as before. And I haven't put any 1 over 2 omegas in because I'm going to put that in the definition of this because it won't be quite, it's not quite so obvious what to do there. So just as the phi satisfies this Heisenberg equation of motion, the u's satisfy exactly the same equation of motion. And all we've got to do is work out what a double prime over a is. So a goes like 1 over eta. I can forget the minus h because that's going to cancel out in the ratio. A double prime over a, so I can just take a goes like 1 over eta. A prime is minus 1 over eta squared. A double prime is 2 over eta cubed. Therefore, a double prime over a is 2 over eta squared. So the individual modes uk satisfy this equation. This is the equation for modes under sit or in flat slicing. Now, this is, we can solve this exactly, but before we solve it exactly, let's just get an intuitive feel for the result. There are two regimes. Essentially, it's a competition between this term and this term. This term is positive and will cause modes to oscillate. Sorry, this term is negative and cause modes to oscillate. This term is positive and will cause modes to grow or decay. And so which one of these two terms dominates is going to be the crucial question.
Well, why should it be a competition? Because if it satisfies the first the equation for the first two terms, then that's zero. So it should always be the propagating mode. Like the solution is the homogeneous solution plus the particular solution, right?
No, this is there's not a source here, right?
There's not a source. Okay.
Yeah, because everything's linear in U, so it's all homogeneous.
Okay.
Yeah. You'd be right if it was a source, but it's not a source. So it's a competition between these two terms, and the ratio of these two terms is set by the combination k eta. And what k eta means physically, so k is the co-moving wavelength, so the physical wavelength, lambda, is the scale factor, A of eta, times the co-moving wavelength, 2 pi over k. That's the physical wavelength of the mode related to k. And A itself is minus 1 over h eta. So this combination is actually negative because in this map, conformal time, as t goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, conformal time goes from minus infinity to zero. So eta is always negative, unfortunately, which means it's natural to think of everything as a function of minus k eta. So this quantity then, rewriting k, so k is minus 2 pi over lambda physical, 2 pi a of eta over lambda physical times eta. And eta itself, I can write as minus 1 over h a of eta. So I can cancel the a's and see that this combination is precisely 2 pi h minus 1 over lambda physical. So this combination k eta measures, so h minus 1, remember, is the physical size of the horizon. Lambda physical is the physical wavelength of the mode. So this combination is small when the wavelengths are very long, much bigger than the horizon size. And the combination is big when the wavelengths are much smaller than the horizon size. Okay? So let's take the case where k eta minus k eta is much bigger than 1. So that's when, if that's my horizon, that's when the wavelengths are much smaller than the horizon. And in that case, the second term is negligible relative to this guy. This guy is winning because k is big. And then we know how to solve that. We know that the properly normalized positive frequency mode goes like that. So that's what the properly normalized positive frequency mode does, very high k, which is small wavelengths, when the wavelength's much smaller than the horizon. In the opposite regime, k eta is much less than 1. So that's when the mode has a much bigger wavelength than the horizon. Looks like that. Then it's the second term that dominates. And in this case, you can see that the solutions are going to be power laws, basically because we're taking u, we're differentiating it twice, and here we're also dividing by 2 powers of eta, so that the powers of eta are always are the same. And so you can see that if you make an ansatz for the solution, uk goes like eta to the s, then uk double prime is s minus 1, eta to the s minus 2, which is supposed to be equal to plus 2 over eta squared uk, which was eta to the s. And so the etas cancel out because you've precisely got eta to the s minus 2 on both sides. And so you find that the powers ss minus 1 have to be equal to 2. And the solutions of that are s is minus 1 or plus 2. So in this regime, uk has two solutions, one going as 1 over eta, and the other going as eta squared. Now, because of the way eta goes, future infinity is actually eta going to 0 because of the rather peculiar nature of the coordinates. So eta is getting smaller and smaller as time increases. So this term is getting bigger. This term is getting smaller. And this is a generic feature of very long wavelength modes when modes go outside the horizon in cosmology. Regardless, even this is during the sitter, but you get the same property during a matter-dominated phase, during a radiation-dominated phase with different powers. And in general, this thing is called the growing mode for obvious reasons, and this is called the decaying mode. Again, for hopefully obvious reasons. So that's approximate intuition of the two solutions. You have something, a positive frequency mode should be properly normalized like this at sub-horizon scales, but then at the horizon, it switches over and it splits into a growing and a decaying mode. It's actually possible to solve this equation exactly, and that you sort of did in the homeworks. And the solution that exactly has this property, went like this: e to the I pi square root minus p pi eta over 2 times a Hankel function h3/2 1 as function of h minus k eta. Probably it's worth you go again over this tomorrow. So that's actually the exact solution. And that's the right solution because the Hankel function h nu of x has the property that as x goes to plus infinity, it goes like square root of a 2 over pi x, e to the I x minus pi for 3 over 2. Well, in general, it's nu pi over 2 minus pi over 4. And here, as eta goes to minus infinity, minus k eta is going to plus infinity. And then this is this factor here multiplies by that factor to make this the correct normalization of 1 over 2, the standard normalization 1 over 2 root k. So this combination is exactly the thing that's correctly normalized to be a positive frequency mode like this at subhorizon scales. So again, following standard arguments we've done before, so modes in which these are defined as the positive frequency modes, so we define the vacuum to be annihilated by the associated annihilation operators. This is called the Bunch-Davis vacuum, just after the people that first came up with it. So remember, our field is a superposition of those modes plus their complex conjugates, integral to 3k, etc., in the usual way, ik dot x, e to the minus ik dot x. So if I choose those to be my positive frequency modes, and I choose the vacuum to be annihilated by a as 0, ak is 0, then that is the Bunch-Davis vacuum. And in that vacuum, if I calculate the two-point function, then it looks like uk of x e to the ik dot x. So, and by x I'm going to mean this is a shorthand for the time coordinate being, no, actually let me use different notation because that's super confusing. The field at time eta and spatial coordinate x times the field at time eta prime, spatial coordinate x prime. Following the standard calculation, this is just equal to uk eta uk star eta prime e to the ik dot x minus x prime. So remember, in Minkowski space, this is the thing that went like e to the I k dot x minus x prime covariantly with the 1 over 2 mod k in there. And I told you a lie, because actually phi itself went like we took an overall 1 over scale factor out. So there's actually an extra 1 over e to a e to 1, 1 over a e to 2. Because if you remember, we did phi was u over a to switch to the previous form. Sorry, I did doing this very quickly, but any questions? Yeah? It is an AK, it's just that there's a remnant of some previous thing, I think. That's right.
And when you say phi is u over a, what u are you talking about?
It's nothing. It's just whatever you want. So it was just the way of solving the equation, right? So the point is that's the solution. Now, and the property of the Bunch-Davis vacuum, so because we're in de Sitter space, there must have been some vacuum state that was de Sitter invariant. And it turns out it's precisely this one. Now, proving that in full generality is a bit complicated, but I can prove to you a simpler fact that it's at least invariant under some of the de Sitter group transformations. So in conformal time, the metric looks like this. Now, one particular de Sitter transformation is if I rescale x goes to lambda x and eta goes to lambda eta, then the metric ds squared goes to ds squared. So that's a symmetry. That's simply because I've got an eta squared on the bottom and I've got eta squared and x squared on the top, which I'm rescaling in exactly the same way. So if this thing is really de Sitter invariant, and I'm not lying to you, then it must satisfy that particular symmetry, which is just a specific transformation of the de Sitter group. So it must satisfy that phi lambda eta, lambda eta 1 lambda x1, phi lambda eta 2 lambda x2, is equal to phi of eta 1 x1, phi of eta 2 x2. So that's saying if I do this de Sitter transformation on both coordinates, I have to get back what I started with. And it's possible to see that this actually does the job, because let's look at what happens when we do these transformations. Eta goes to lambda eta. So when we do x goes to lambda x, the Fourier transform, k is the Fourier mode associated with that, so conceptually k is like I d by dx, and so k has to scale as 1 over lambda k, because these two are conjugate. You can also say in phase space, it's the position times the momentum that will be conserved, so if you multiply the position by lambda, you have to divide the momentum by lambda. So under that transformation, the combination k eta is invariant, because it goes as 1 over lambda k times lambda eta, so it's mod k eta. So the combination inside the Hankel function is invariant. That doesn't do anything whatsoever. The only thing that changes is the eta here, the k here, and the a is there. So each individual mode u picks up a lambda to the half because of the eta that's sat here. The spatial dependence e to the ik dot x minus x prime doesn't change because we've rescaled k as 1 over lambda and we've rescaled x the same way. So u scales like lambda to the half u. So uu star scales like lambda uu star. The integral d3k scales like lambda to the minus 3 integral d3k. And then the overall 1 over a eta 1, a eta 2 in front, because a goes like 1 over eta, then a goes to 1 over lambda a. So this goes to lambda squared. So the 1 over a, the two factors of 1 over a in front, that gives me a lambda squared, this gives me a lambda minus 3, this combination gives me a plus lambda, and I find that this is really invariant. Yep?
Would it always be true that the mode functions that satisfy your equations of motion will correspond to physical vacuum?
They always correspond to physical vacuum as long as they're normalized, yeah.
Okay.
But they're not always de Sitter invariant, right? So this is the unique combination that's de Sitter invariant.
Okay, so, these are the more functions that satisfy your equations of motion for the de Sitter phase with the affected mass, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that equation is unique, right? And those are the ones that have to be de Sitter invariant.
Yeah, but we just took one particular solution, but there was a combination. We also had the Hankel 2 function, right? And we could have taken an arbitrary combination of the two. So the reason we picked out this one is this is the one that looks like a positive frequency mode at very high energies. So that really is the de Sitter invariant vacuum. And you can go through and do all the transformations, or you can just explicitly calculate this and find that it's de Sitter invariant. So so I've run out of time. So the last thing I wanted to do, but I guess I don't quite have time, was to say, so this is the modes defined on the flat slicing. Like that. When you convert to modes on the static slicing, so just as we did in the Unruh effect, where we took modes, in the Unruh effect, if you remember what we did yesterday, is we took modes that were defined on the Minkowski space in the global slicing, and then we rewrote them as modes that we defined in the Rindler patch. And we found that we had a combination of positive and negative frequencies. And that combination was such that mod alpha over beta squared went like e to the e over kt, where e was mod k kappa, and the temperature went like a over 2 pi. And the essence of that transformation is because you have a horizon and you're taking something defined of the global slice and putting it onto something that's defined on the sub-slice here on the static patch. And if we do exactly the same for de Sitter, following the same tricks, if we rewrite the modes UK, eta, which go like Hankel functions, so if we take this mode and we rewrite it as a combination of modes that are defined on the static slicing, where T is the coordinate in the static slicing, we did exactly the same calculation, we would also find that mod alpha over mod beta squared went like e to the e over kt, where e is mod k, kappa. And now the temperature comes out, let me get this the right way around, as h over 2 pi k. And this really just follows, you know, sort of automatically just from the fact that, you know, the Rindler space is this region, and de Sitter, it's exactly the same thing. You really go through exactly the same calculation. So the difference is, in Minkowski space, an observer at rest doesn't see temperature, but if he accelerates, then he sees a temperature which goes like his acceleration. Whereas in de Sitter, an observer who's at rest sees a temperature which scales like the Hubble constant. And all observers who are inertially related see the same temperature. And this is one of the most profound things about de Sitter space. You can never not see that temperature. You might see the temperature in something else, but you'll never not see the temperature. There's no state in which an observer in de Sitter never sees the temperature. And that physical fact that de Sitter has temperature also implies, just as in the black hole case, that de Sitter has entropy. So whenever you have temperature, you have entropy as well. And so the geometry of de Sitter space, of de Sitter, has a finite entropy. And that entropy, just as in the black hole case, the entropy scales like 1/4 in units where g equals 1. So it's 1 over 4g times the area of the black hole horizon. That's the black hole formula. And I'm using units where 1 over 8 pi g is m Planck squared. So I'd have written that as, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter on the units. So the black hole scales like the area. In the de Sitter case, the entropy also scales like the area with exactly the same formula, except now the area is the area of the horizon. What's the area of the horizon? The horizon was this surface R is H minus 1. And if I induce this metric on that surface, then essentially this thing goes to 0 This thing looks like it's becoming singular, but it actually goes to zero by an appropriate coordinate transformation. And this thing determines the area, and the area is precisely 4 pi times the radius squared. There's nothing funny going on here, it's just the standard answer. And the radius is h minus 1, so it's 4 pi over h squared. So De Sitter space has an entropy that goes like pi h minus 2 over g. And that entropy is precisely consistent with that temperature. So the higher the curvature, the higher the temperature, but the lower the entropy. The lower the curvature, the higher the entropy. So in the limit in which we recover Minkowski space, you're actually taking a limit where h goes to 0, and the entropy is actually going to infinity. And just as in the black hole case, this fact that De Sitter has a finite entropy is one of the most suggestive things, again, about that we know maybe about quantum gravity. Whatever quantum theory of gravity you come up with has to explain this fact. Why do we have an entropy? What is it the entropy of? What is it counting the number of microstates of? And nobody has a clue in the De Sitter case. People know in the black hole case, but in the De Sitter case, no one has a clue. Any space with a cosmological horizon or a black hole horizon has an entropy. ADS doesn't, because it has no horizons, right? But you can have a black hole in ADS, and then it has one. Yeah.
So do we see this temperature in our universe?
Yeah, we do. But if you calculate it, it's like incredibly small. So the CMB is at like 3 Kelvin, and this temperature is like 10 to the minus 20 Kelvin. So, I mean, I can't even remember the number, but it's negligible. So in practice, you can't observe it. But in principle, it's there. Like the Henry effect. It's quite difficult to see. Anyway, sorry, I've gone way over time.